This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Shug McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm Mike Penna, the Baron of the Backstretch. This is the show that trainers listen to, and I am very happy to have you along for the ride with me this afternoon. As always, you are listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you are tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show, and you're doing that through our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, on last week's show, you heard the story of a man who has been involved in this sport for more than 40 years, trainer Ron Stevens, and it was a really enjoyable visit for me anyway, and I hope you enjoyed it too. He told some great stories. You can go back to our website and listen to the podcast at your leisure. Today, I'm going to flip the script a little bit as I visit with an individual who is on the exact opposite end of the spectrum. Born in Canada, the 33-year-old is just getting started with what he hopes will be a long and prosperous career. And if he can follow in the footsteps of the Hall of Famers he's been privileged to learn from the past several years, it would be very, very difficult to bet against him. Please join me in welcoming trainer Jamie Begg to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Jamie, appreciate the visit, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
Yeah, my pleasure, and excited to hear your story. But I want to start, for our listeners anyway, by putting a few things in perspective. The two Hall of Famers that you worked for before recently going out on your own aren't your everyday run-of-the-mill Hall of Famers. They are dual Hall of Famers, Roger Atfield and Mark Cassie, both members of the U.S. and Canadian Hall of Fames. Combined, those two trainers have saddled more than 29,000 starters. Their runners have earned nearly $300 million in purses, which includes a multitude of graded stakes wins. Now, Jamie, you saddled starter number one on December 18th at Turfway Park. That horse, Weekend Fund, now has $272 in purse earnings. And the reason I present it in that fashion is because that is one hell of a lot of knowledge and success to draw upon as you begin your training career.
Yeah, it was a real honor to work for guys such as Roger and Mark. Very different training styles, but so I took a little bit from each one of them. And I believe that they are the only two dual Hall of Famers that have ever lived. I could be wrong on that, but I believe that's true.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the only two members of both Hall of Fames, and that's just incredible. And for you to learn from them, that's something that you can cherish for the rest of your life. And I'm sure you're going to take things from each one and incorporate them into your training regimen now. But when you hear those kinds of numbers and you walk over the other night with your very first starter, is there part of you, Jamie, that says, man, you know, I've been around this. I know what it looks like. I know what it feels like. I know what it tastes like to have that kind of success. That's got to be my goal moving forward. Someday I want Jamie Begg to be a name that's recognized like a Mark Cassie, like a Roger Atfield. Is that something that's kind of a goal for you as you get started?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty hefty goal. If I could accomplish half of what either one of those guys had done, I'd feel like that was a pretty successful career. But I think it's all about taking it one day at a time and just taking care of the horses you have and doing the best by them. And if you take care of them, they'll take care of you.
Why was this the right time to make the move and go out on your own?
It just seemed right. I'd been working for Mark for quite a few years, and we'd had quite a bit of success with him And it was one of those things. I just was at a point in my life. I needed something a little more. I felt like it had kind of run its course, and they were kind of getting out of New York for the winter and start doing a turf wastering with a lot of those Woodbine horses he had. And so it just seemed like the right time.
Well, Mark was quoted in an article, it might have been in Blood Horse or Daily Racing Form recently, that talked about you going out on your own. And he said, "I thought he did a wonderful job for us," referring to you. He said, "He's a hardworking, young, knowledgeable guy that should enjoy a good career." What's it mean to hear those words from a guy like Mark Cassie?
Oh, it's huge, you know. And I must say, working for Mark, I don't think he's not a better guy you could work for, and at least from my experiences in the horse racing game. So, like Roger was good, but I obviously spent a lot more time with Mark and had a bit more of an integral role when I worked for Mark. And yeah, the way he really gives you freedom to kind of develop yourself for getting horses ready under his tutelage. So
you started with Mark in what, 2013? Is that right?
I worked for him for a few months in 2013. For 6 months, I went down to Palm Meadows and I worked with Norman, his son, with that, the Florida string. And then when I returned home, that's when I started working for Roger, and I worked for Roger for 2 years. And then I was actually on my way down to Florida with Roger when Mark actually called me and offered me an assistant job, starting off with him in Ocala, because we knew each other, but he hadn't seen me work. He wanted me to kind of run a string down there under his nose so that he could really see and make sure that I was doing the things the way he wanted them done, in which case we moved forward from there.
He sent me a picture earlier this year when he was on the show. He and I are both big fans of baseball. I played growing up, and of course Norman played, and Mark's other son. And he built a baseball field at his farm in Ocala, which is, it's like a field of dreams. It is beautiful. I believe the pond is out in left field, so if you hit it into the pond, it's an automatic home run. But this was that picture. It was just a gorgeous baseball field that he's put in. Did you ever get a chance to play on the field?
The field was built, I think it was 2 years ago. We pulled out of New York for the winter, and so I went down and worked at the training center there with Mitch Downs and Mark. And so he didn't have the field built at the time. He just had a batting net. And sometimes when he would go out of town, I would take care of Colby. And so he was like, "Oh, will you catch for me?" Because he's a pretty avid pitcher. And so he said, "Will you catch for me?" And I'm like, "Yeah, no problem." I don't really play baseball that much. I played a little bit in high school, but more so in Canada, we play more softball. So I'm like, "Oh, how hard could it be to catch for him?" And he threw a few heaters at me. I got in all the gear, and he threw a few heaters at me. And he threw a slider at me, and I decided that day that it was a good time to go to Dick's Sporting Goods and get a cup.
Yeah, he is one heck of a pitcher. Mark tells me the stories of him and his games that he plays, but he's a heck of a pitcher. And Norman, his other son, who you talked about working with him, he played in college. He's an avid baseball player too.
Yeah, and I'm more towards the hockey side of things, coming from Canada. So I played a little bit of baseball. We kind of dabbled in a bunch of sports, but never got huge into the baseball.
Who's your hockey team?
The Maple Leafs.
How about a baseball team? Is it all about the Blue Jays?
A little bit. Like I said, I'm not a huge baseball guy. I follow the Blue Jays and the Raptors, but I'm not as into it as, I don't follow them as closely as I would the Maple Leafs.
Talking with trainer Jamie Begg, now out on his own, as you heard, or if you are just joining us and you missed it, he has worked for two, maybe the only two, I think they are the only two dual Hall of Famers in thoroughbred racing history, Roger Atfield and Mark Cassie. Spent more time with Mark, was an assistant for Mark before recently going out on his own. He started his first horse December 18th at Turfway, Weekend Fund, who finished seventh in that race, but bigger things ahead for Jamie Begg. There's no doubt about it, especially when you have that kind of pedigree and you work with those types of trainers. Let's talk about your time with Roger for a minute. I know that you said you had a more integral role and spent more time with Mark, but tell me about being around Roger Atfield.
Roger's just a great horseman, really cool guy to get to know. Like, and you see, he's one where you look back and his accomplishments dating so far back, all the Canadian Triple Crown winners he's had, and the grass horses that he's trained. It's pretty incredible. And he's kind of, you almost get a little starstruck just because of the history that he has in the sport.
What makes Roger such a good trainer?
I think with Roger, it's very much a horse thing. He doesn't get into a lot of the other stuff that some of the other guys do with the placing. Like, he's very much, he develops young horses, and he seems to be able to string their careers along for extended periods of time with a lot of hands-on and being really, really involved with them. So
I'm going to ask you the same question about Mark, but in terms of Roger, Jamie, if there is one aspect of what he does, one characteristic, one approach, one philosophy, whatever it is, if there's one thing you can take away from being around Roger and incorporate it into what you do today now that you're training on your own, what one thing would it be?
I think it's the fact that a lot of things with horses, he kind of trains them through stuff. He doesn't always go right to vets and try and deal with issues. Like, he's really old school in that regard. I remember when I worked for him, I actually had a yearling. It was a 2-year-old, but it was a yearling I couldn't get sold. So I ended up just saying, I'll just take it with us down to Payson. And so it was pretty cool having him, because I could kind of mess around with my own horse and just spitball, throw things off him and stuff. And I remember I had a horse come up with a little issue or something, and I was like, yeah, I think you're just going to give him like a week off or something. And Roger was like, what are you doing giving him a week off? You need to just keep him going out there. Like, don't train hard on him. Don't do much with him. Just jog him, but make sure you keep him moving, keep him doing stuff, because he'll get through it better. If you let him just sit in the stall and walk around, you're just going to run back into the same problem once you try and start him back. So he goes, just keep going with him. He'll get through it.
Well, that's interesting. And great for you to be able to rely on a guy like Roger and get that kind of advice, because, to me, that's, if I'm getting started with any profession, you want to have that type of a mentor that you can go back to and draw on their experience, because he certainly had the experience. How about with Mark Cassie? If you were to describe Mark and his approach to training horses, how would you do it?
I think Mark, the main thing that he has really going for him and with training the horses is that he has all the babies there with him in Ocala, which is kind of the hub. And anytime there's an issue with the horse that we can't figure out, they go back down there. And he has so many things down there at his disposal. He has a swimming pool. There's turnout at the farm. It's just a way more laid back situation where I feel like some other guys would keep those horses and try and get them through at the track, whereas some horses just need to go back to a more laid back area, somewhere where they can kind of recoup and work through things. And having all those things at his disposal, I think, are huge. And the fact that because everything starts and goes there, you kind of, between the two of you, we would always bounce ideas off of each other, and he knows the horses from when they're first starting out, so and throughout, every time they go back down there. So I think that's a big thing, and the fact that he has different operations with different guys that work for him, so if one thing's not working, there's a lot of good horsemen in that operation that he can try with. So if it's not working for somebody, he can move it. If it's not working at a certain track, he can move it. So it's the is the ability to move the horses to a situation that suits them best pretty seamlessly. That I think is the biggest positive of Mark's operation, I would say.
If you can emulate one thing that Mark does and bring it over to your operation, what's that one thing going to be?
I think Mark does a good job of getting his 2-year-olds ready to go early. I like developing horses, but there's something to be said for certain horses need to be ready from jump street to run, because they will be more successful in their career if they can do that early on, before some of the bigger, more difficult, better horses get into the running ranks.
Visiting with trainer Jamie Begg here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Let's go back to a few days ago, December 18th, and weekend fun. You lead weekend fun over for that, I believe it was the fifth race at Turfway that night. Your very first starter on your own. You're no stranger to saddling horses. You've done that working as Mark's assistant, and we're going to talk more about some of those horses later in the program. But what was it like walking over with a horse that you were saddling in your own name?
It was pretty stressful, I'm not going to lie. it was funny. I walked it over and the filly went out onto the track, and Anna and David Mia were standing on the rail there with me. And I said, it's funny, I've worked for Mark and I've saddled grade one winners. I've been there in Breeders' Cup days, like the highest stress, like the upper echelon of this industry. And I said, I've never been so nervous to run a horse in my life. And I said, it's just a 2X at Turfway. So it's a pretty tough race, but I thought it was a good spot to start that filly off, see if she liked the poly. So.
Yeah, why do you think it was so much different? Like you said, you've been there, done that. I mean, why all of a sudden does it become so much different when it's your name in the program, Jamie?
Well, I think part of it was the fact that it was mine, but I think it also, a lot of it had to just do with the fact it was the first one. So I know you got a lot of family and friends and stuff watching, so you're like, I don't want to mess this one up. So.
It's so funny you say that, because I remember I had a similar experience at Turfway, not on the training side, because I've never done that before, but I grew up wanting to be a track announcer, and Mike Battaglia was so good to me, and he was so nice that one night I would go up to Turfway and I would practice into a tape recorder, and one night he said, hey, listen, I have to leave early. Would you mind calling the last race? And he gave me a couple days notice, and I said, sure, that would be wonderful. And I can remember a very similar experience to what you went through. I was up in the announcer's booth, and I'd studied the field ever since the entries came out, 48 hours before. And I put my binoculars up on the starting gate just as they were going in. And Jamie, I promise you, I couldn't see the gate. I was shaking so bad, and my binoculars were shaking, and everything was bouncing up and down. And it was because of the fact, not that I hadn't done it before, but it was because of the fact that I had so many people that I had told about this, and it was on TVG, and I knew people were watching, and it took the experience to a whole new level, very similar to what you went through.
Yeah, it would have almost been better if it happened last minute and you just had to jump in there, because then it's the days leading up to it that you're overthinking everything, I think, is the main thing. When I was working for Mark, you know, you got runners every day, you're always busy, you're doing your thing. And when you get something like that where it's like the first one, you're sitting waiting. So the wait is almost worse than the experience itself.
Well, that's it too, because you had to they race at night at Turfway. Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You had to wait around all day long thinking about it, talking about it, and then as it gets closer and closer and closer, the nerves start to build. But it's out of the way now. So when you saddle your second horse, do you expect that you'll be a little more composed, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was just the initial one, just get that one out of the way. Like I said, the filly, she ran a decent race. She actually looked okay turning for home. We were a little disappointed with the end result, but it was one of those things where after you're just like, I'm just glad we just at least we got that out of the way. Like, just get around there, and then we can move on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, is she the only horse in your barn right now?
No, no. I have I got a old horse of Fletcher's, Current. He won the Bourbon Stakes.
Yep.
He's in my barn, and then I got some two-year-olds coming in. So.
So you start right off with a stakes winner in your barn. That's not too bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a. I kind of went through with my dad. We went to that horse's a racing age sale, and he had sold a few of his brood mares. So we were actually looking for some fillies that we could get black type on. That was the weekend fun move of more than ready mare. So it was kind of to help revamp his brood mare band, sorry. And Current came up, and I know Aaron Wellman a little, and so is my dad. We're close enough with him to talk to him. So I called him up and I was just like, hey, you got this horse in here. Like, what's your plans with him? And he was just like, well, we got a lot of people in on the horse. So he goes, we're just going to let it ride. So we're hoping we could maybe get him a little cheaper than we did, but I think he's a reasonable, and we're going to try and get him turned back around. And he still has a lot of conditions left for a horse that's as accomplished as he is. So he's actually still a 2X. So I think he's one we could have some fun with leading into next year.
You've referenced your dad a couple of times now, Jeffrey, and he has had a lot of success in this business. He had his farm, Windways Farm, which was the family farm up in Canada. Your grandfather, James, who is your namesake as well, was involved in the sport. So you come from a long line of horsemen. Tell me more about your dad and your grandfather and being around that growing up.
Before my grandfather passed away, we actually owned a couple of broodmares together, and we had, unfortunately, it was after he passed away, but we sold one pretty well. But so he was very supportive of me early on. We partnered on, like I said, a few broodmares. We sold a Henny Hughes for six figures, so it was cool. And he always would tell me before he passed away, when we had those yearlings coming up, he was like, well, if they don't give us what we want, we'll run them. We'll run them. So, and unfortunately, he didn't make it that long to see them go through the ring even. So that was unfortunate, but it was cool with him. And my dad actually trained for a little bit back in the 80s. I actually think he trained a stakes winner in the 1 year that he trained horses. But he was very close with Malcolm Pierce growing up. His dad ran the farm across the street from ours. And so I think my dad did it for a year, and then Malcolm was kind of thinking about going out from Sam, working under Frostad at the time. So he was like, well, you train him. If I ever get anything I want to run, I'll just send it to you. And I'm going to go home and have the family and run the farm. The horse race, the training game's a little hard to have families, from what a lot of people have said. There's a lot of moving around, so he decided to do more of the farm and the breeding side of it from then on out.
Well, that turned out pretty good too, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You look at some of the horses he bred, names like, you know, Victor Cooley come to mind, winner of the Queen's Plate in 96, El Brujo, another one that was a grade one winner. Wild Desert, didn't he breed Wild Desert too?
Yeah.
Who won the Queen's Plate? Yeah.
Yeah, and then trying to think who else. There are a few other graded horses as well. No other grade one winners, but those are the big ones. There's another horse, Solitaire, that he bred that I think was that James Bond had. That I think was won a few stakes as well. So
yeah, I think there was question, what was it, 2014, when your dad sold the farm and downsized, whether he would stay involved or how he would stay involved. And it's great to see that he still is involved. And now you get to go down this road with him, you know, side by side and work together in some respects, much like Norman and Mark got to do. And that's got to be a cool thing too, isn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, for sure. The funny thing is, a lot of people think that because of the success that my dad's had, that we had some giant breeding operation. We never really had all that many mares. He never, I don't believe he ever had more than 10 mares at any given time. So he just always, he was very much a stickler for quality over quantity. He always wanted to make sure that the mares that he had were good and were producing good foals. And if they weren't, then he just, he didn't want to, didn't really keep any of those ones around. He moved mares around a lot, just trying to get, like I said, the best quality he could. He didn't want a big old broodmare band. So, and then he had a few clients, and I actually ran a layup and breeding operation when I was younger, when around my early 20s, called Kingstead Stables. And we actually used to sell and breed some horses. So near the end of it, I actually had rented out a bunch of the farm off of him. So we kind of had the two operations operating off the one farm. And so after I decided to stop doing that, he decided to get a smaller farm with a bit more acreage a little further north. So,
you know, it's funny, Jamie, so many trainers that have come on the show over the years share your background where they have been involved in the sport for a very young age. Their family was involved, whatever it might be. And I'm just kind of curious, was there ever a time when you thought about not being involved in horse racing?
When I was younger, I really got away from the farm quite a bit. We had a place in Northern Ontario on the lake, and I actually went to boarding school up there. And it was a very outdoor educated based school. And that's a very kind of, it's almost like a Saratoga type area, very cottagey.
Yep.
And so I had a place up there, and I actually used to live up there all year round, and I would come back to the farm just randomly. So I did a lot of stuff up there with boats and worked at marinas and did all that kind of stuff growing up. A lot of times growing up, I wasn't so much on the horse side of it. I showed when I was younger, and then like in my teenage years or early teens, I was up there all the time. I think mostly because of the fact that on the lake you can get around in boats when you're younger before you get your license. So it was one of those things where I felt like I had a little more freedom to drive around and go to jobs and do whatever I wanted to do. But then near the end of high school, I started playing polo a bunch.
Okay.
And so that's what kind of brought me back to the farm. And then when I was looking career options, it seemed like the best equine sport to make any money in was the thoroughbred industry. So that's when I got into that, and I got into breeding. I started buying a couple, cheaper brood mares, and I did some selling, sold some horses, just kind of wheeling and dealing a little bit and breaking and getting into all that stuff. So that's when I would say near the end of high school, early college is when I really got back into it.
Visiting with Jamie Begg here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Just getting started with that training career, but as you heard in the first half of the show, he's been around some of the best to ever saddle a racehorse, and he's learned from them, and now he's taking that and moving forward with his own operation. When I come back, we'll talk about some of the top horses he's had the privilege to be around. That's next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. The heat is on in February at Fasig Tipton. Fasig Tipton is still accepting entries for the 2021 Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale, the last breeding stock sale of the season. In 2020, the sale produced scorching results with a $575,000 sale-topping broodmare prospect, a $310,000 in-foal broodmare, and a $265,000 short yearling. Enter now for the Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale to be held February 8th and 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be? Introducing racing's newest partnership experience, the Horse and Julep Racing Club. Come see what makes us so different. The inaugural partnership club is forming right now and will purchase yearlings at the Keeneland January sale under the eye of rising star agent Phil Hager. The horses will go to historic Darby Dan Farm, whose land has raised no fewer than 6 Kentucky Derby winners. Partners should plan for a meetup there to visit the farm, the horses, and the best of the bluegrass. Visit horseandjulep.club today to reserve your spot. Horseandjulep.club.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And they're into the stretch, and it is Jovia and Tex. Sir Winston comes up on the outside, and he got in front of War of Will. And Sir Winston has moved to the center of the track under Joel Rosario to take the lead. On the inside, Jovia fights on. Tacitus is there, and then Tex between horses. Master Fencer on the far outside. They're coming to the finish, and Sir Winston has won the Belmont Stakes. And then it was Tacitus second, followed by Jovia third. It's a photo for fourth. The final time was 2 minutes, 28.30 seconds.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday program. And Larry Colmus with the call of last year's Belmont Stakes. Sir Winston giving Mark Cassie two-thirds of the Triple Crown with two different horses after War of Will scored in the Preakness. And what a performance it was by Sir Winston. I'm going to talk more with our special guest, Jamie Begg, about Sir Winston and about that performance in the Belmont Stakes, as he was very close to that horse working with Mark Cassie. We'll get into that coming up shortly, but want to remind you that if you did miss any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast of this program and all of our shows at your leisure. And by the way, you can also do it on Apple Podcasts. That's all there for you, Apple Podcasts and horseracingradio.net. Well, Jamie, that stretch call has to bring back some amazing memories, even though it's only last year. It has to bring back some amazing memories for you.
Yeah, no, for sure. That was probably one of the coolest days I've ever been around with horse racing.
Yeah, tell me about it. What was it like?
It's not much that you can use to describe it. It's just it was kind of, when it was happening, it was kind of disbelief. So I knew the horse was doing well, and I was really confident in him going the mile and a half, and he was training lights out, and I just thought I had him figured out. So I knew he was going to put in a big performance, but when he actually did it, it was kind of mind-blowing.
You spent a lot of time overseeing Mark's operation in New York, and of course that meant that you worked with Sir Winston closely. What was... He described your relationship with Sir Winston. He talked about how you just kind of got along really well with him. What does that mean when somebody says a trainer gets along well with a horse, and it's different than anybody else that would be around that horse? What was it like for you?
It was pretty cool. We had a bit of a connection, and I also just think he had a certain way that he liked to do things, the horse, and I guess I saw it, and that was kind of it. Once we trained to change his training regimen to suit him, I think it really helped him blossom, and also just the distance of the races helped him a bit, but I think it more had to do with training him the way he wanted to be trained.
See, I guess that's where I'm going with that. You say you had a connection, and a trainer talks about having a connection with a horse. Don't you have a connection to all your horses, or can it be different from horse to horse?
It can be different, and there's some horses that you can't figure them out, or they don't like where they are, or whatever. It seemed like Winston, whenever he came back, he had the same groom all the time, the guy that rubbed him. Humberto Gonzalez, and he seemed to be, they seemed to get along. They're kind of like brothers. They used to fight in the stall all the time. So I thought it was, I think he liked it. He seemed whenever he got around him, he kind of puffed up. So I think that was a bit integral part as well.
Well, Sir Winston wasn't the only good horse that you had the chance to work with when you were working with Mark. There were others too. Tell me about some of the others you had the chance to be around.
So when I first started working for, Mark, and like I said, we went down to Ocala, and at the time my dad had just bought into, he had just bought 3-yearling fillies that he kind of wanted to do the same thing. He wanted to race some fillies and see what he could do with them. And he was going to pick one to sell at a 2-year-old sale. And he kind of got with Mark and was talking to Mark about it and asking him what he thought. And Mark was like, well, I got another idea. Why don't you send me all 3 of them, and I'll get Gary Barber to buy you out of 1/3 of them. And that'll be the same as selling 1 of them. And he goes, well, that will work. And so that's, and one of those 3 horses was Catch a Glimpse, who won the Juvenile Fillies Turf in 2015. And so I had her when she first went to the track. I had her for a little bit and I really liked her. And then she went up to Saratoga. She went up to Woodbine. And then when she came back to Kentucky at Keeneland, I was running Keeneland at the time. And so I got to prep her into that Breeders' Cup race. And that was pretty cool. That was actually Mark's first Breeders' Cup win.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It was
the next. Yeah, and then the next day he won with Teppan.
Yeah, because we were talking about that in an interview that Mark did with me. I guess maybe it was before this year's Breeders' Cup. And I remember doing an interview with him before the 15 Breeders' Cup, and we talked about him potentially being the best trainer never to win a Breeders' Cup race. And then all of a sudden, here comes Catch a Glimpse, and here comes Teppan, and now he's on a roll, and he seems like he wins them every single year now. But he finally broke through with Catch a Glimpse. And obviously you had a big hand in that. You have to be very proud of that, Jamie.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And doing it for my family was extra special. So,
what did your dad say when you told him that you were going to go out on your own and be a trainer full time?
He had a little bit of advice. Like, we talk all the time, obviously, because I have a few of his horses here. But he was kind of just like, yeah, whatever you want to do, like, if you feel like it's right, then do it. So,
wow. Yeah, nice. It's great to have that kind of support like that. And, you know, especially from somebody like your dad, who's had so much success in this game and been in it, you know, for so many years. I asked you what makes Mark Cassie and Roger Atfield such good horsemen, such good horse trainers. How about your dad? What makes him so savvy and so good at what he's done over the years?
I'd say the one thing that he has going for him is the fact that he's kind of, there's no horse sport that he hasn't at least attempted, and he's kind of just always goes about, he's very much for the horse. I know there's some guys, especially in this game, that they do speed figures or they do pedigrees. There's certain pedigrees they like, or this or that and the other. And with my dad, it always seems to be he loves standout individuals. Like, he likes good looking horses. And I feel like if you look for athletes, which this is a sport of athletes, if you're always looking for athletic animals, you tend to do well. I think it's pretty that simple, that if you just hone in on that. And so, and also, like I said, doing all the other disciplines, you can take little things from every discipline. Some of the disciplines disagree with certain things that other ones do, but if you're open-minded to everything that people have done with horses, I feel like you can't ever get boxed in somewhere.
Is it different training a horse that is owned by your dad and having your family involved as opposed to training a horse for an outside client?
I'd say the positive training for my dad is the fact that he's been around, he knows horses. And so there's certain things where you can just you can just be real blunt with him about things, where there's some other owners where you kind of want to keep them happy and keep the, while doing the best by the horse. And so sometimes you kind of have to try and talk them through things or this and that, where he's the, my dad, because he's been with horses, done so much stuff with horses, you can call him and just be like, here's the deal. I think this, like, I think we should do this. This should be our game plan. It may take a little longer. It's going to do this. And you can be more upfront about it. Like, this may take a little more time, but I think at the end of the day, if we do this, it'll be the right thing to do. And so you're not worried about sometimes telling him things that maybe
other owners... Does he listen when you tell him that? Does he listen?
No.
It's funny. The reason I ask you that question, my longtime partner here on the show, Jude Feld, he's a trainer in California for many years, and he got to be around Charlie Whittingham. And he said Charlie had a saying that said the owners should be kept in the dark and covered in manure. He would always say that about his owners, basically saying, hey, I'm the trainer of the horse. Let me make the decisions. And you just kind of stay in your lane almost and be the owner. Different when it's your father, and different when your father's had so much success as a horseman and knows the game, as you just alluded to. But, I can see that. That dynamic has to be a little different when it's your family.
Yeah. No, and it's gotten to the point too where, and that's why I like going out and working for other guys. I know a lot of people that are related to people in the game. They try and stay close to home. Like, my dad has horses and training with some other trainers as well. And that's one of the, I like to just go out and do my own thing and show my own successes, so that when now I have a little more clout in the arguments than I did before. So now when he disagrees with me, and be like, remember when I had this horse? We did that with this horse, and it seemed to work. Okay, do you want to do it still? Or so it gives. At least you have a little more clout in the argument. So.
Yeah, a little bit of street cred there for my special guest, Jamie Begg, who was with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. You probably could have gone several directions in terms of a location to base your new operation, but you chose Kentucky. How come?
I just think Kentucky seems to be the place. A lot of guys are migrating back this way due to the fact that some of the other areas, like New York's just very expensive. I didn't see a long-term deal in New York just because of the expense of doing business there. When someone as successful as Kieran McLaughlin closes down his stable due to economics, you know that that's probably not the best route to go. So New York was where I was, and I don't like the city life. So I felt like Kentucky just seemed like the right place to go. All the horses were here. Some of the tracks are, there's a lot of moving parts right now in the horse industry, but I feel like Kentucky, if there's ever going to be a place where, if there's only one place left running horses, it'll probably be here. So I thought it was just the safest place in the epicenter of the thoroughbred industry. So
what are some of the biggest challenges that a new trainer just getting started on their own faces, Jamie?
I think it's a lot of things. Getting everything set up. There's a lot of money invested up front in order to get everything set up. Once you, like in a normal business year, training horses, you're looking to make money and kind of go that way, where I feel like in your first year, you're hoping just to get everything set up and not take too big of a hit in doing it. And then also just getting guys in your barn. Luckily for me, I'd worked for Mark, and I've talked to people, and I've been in this industry long enough that I have a lot of connections, so that's not as hard building connections. But with people that are first getting into this game, I feel like a lot of people move horses to them, but a lot of the guys that move horses are the guys that move them a lot. So you'd rather just slowly get people, really loyal owners, just get a few horses for them in your barn just to get your foot in the door and build a positive relationship with them.
I don't know the number, the exact number of horses that Mark currently has in training, but it's a lot. And he has horses all over the country, basically all over the North America. When you look at Woodbine too, do you want it be that big with your operation, or do you want it to be a little more Tiffany and boutique?
I'd probably want to be a little more boutique. Mark's a special guy to be able to handle all the things he does, and I'm sure it wears on him sometimes. But I like to be a little more hands on with it. So I don't think you can get, or at least that I'd want to get that big. I'd rather, like, I'd probably have a couple of strings, but not at the extent that Mark does.
Outside of Mark and Roger and your father, who have been big influences on you and your career, who are some of the other people that you've gone to kind of pick their brain and ask questions of as you've been kind of working your way up through and getting ready to make this move?
A few of the guys that I've really talked to and worked with, someone like Ron Anderson, who has Joel Rosario and Johnny V's book now. He's been pretty integral. I've picked his brain quite a bit about it. He's been very supportive of me throughout my career working with Mark, and obviously we've had success with Joel riding some pretty nice horses for us, and Johnny V as well. And then someone like, there's a few bloodstock agents that I've talked to that have been pretty supportive, picking their brains. And then a big support group that I would say that I've used is other young trainers, because of the fact that they've just recently done this. And so sometimes it's better to learn from other people's mistakes than your own. And so I've known Kent Sweezy for a long time. We actually did the Irish National Stud together in 2007. Yep. And so I've known him since back when we used to breed. His dad actually used to have some of my broodmares at their farm, Timbertown. Mm-hmm. So I know him pretty well. So I've called him a bunch about things just from when he was getting started. So, and Rob Atris up in New York, he's a friend of mine. He's from Manitoba, fellow Canadian, and another guy that I've gone to asking questions about getting started and things you did right, things you did wrong, and his wife Brittany as well, because she does a lot of the day-to-day managing of their operation. So that's been extremely helpful to me.
Yeah, and those other trainers have all been on this show at one time or another in recent years. And it's always amazing to me, Jamie, when you think about this sport and this industry, that here you are essentially competing with them, meaning you could have a horse in a race and they could have a horse in a race and you're both trying to win, right? But there's this bond that exists among horse trainers in racing where you can go to other trainers and sit there in the morning and have a cup of coffee and bounce ideas off of each other. And even though you're competitors, you're still trying to help each other along. And I think that's a fascinating dynamic with thoroughbred racing.
Yeah. And it's funny, I don't think there's been any bigger year than this year for having relationships such as that. With all the COVID restrictions at a lot of the racetracks, sometimes you have to move horses to run where in a certain spot, and because of COVID, no one was able to move. So I think having those personal relationships with people that you trust, being able to send horses around in order to get them in the right spot and taken care of, I think it has been integral in a year with COVID and all the restrictions that they've put in place.
That's a great point. And did you at any point think, okay, maybe I'll postpone this move to go out on my own until after this passes and things will be a little bit easier in terms of the travel restrictions? Or did you just barrel, obviously you barreled right ahead and you're doing it now, but was there a point where you said, maybe I'll just hold off for a little bit?
I think when you go out on, like, when you start a business and you go on your own, there is no easy. It's difficult, and it's a lot of learning and stuff like that. And so I felt that I feel like we're at the tail end, at least, of the pandemic and the restrictions. But I felt like it wasn't, you just go ahead and do it. And if you can survive through this with the COVID, it's only going to be easier once you get up to the other side. So.
And talking with trainer Jamie Begg, who is now out on his own, as you heard, if you didn't hear it, he has saddled one horse that came on the 18th of December at Turfway, and he has a few other ones in his barn that he's looking to get started and get rolling in the right direction, and he spent time around some of the best. If you could win, as a native of Canada, Jamie, I'll ask you this question. If you could win either the Queen's Plate or the Kentucky Derby, which one's it going to be?
The Derby. That's the apex. That's the Super Bowl. The Queen's Plate would be cool, and I'd love to do it, but it's not the Derby. So I feel like that's one of the things has eluded us since I've been with Mark and with Roger. I've never been a part of a Derby winner in any facet. I've actually never even been to the Derby, to be perfectly honest.
Really?
Yeah. I felt like I always told myself, because it got to a point where it was almost a joke that I hadn't been before. And so I kind of told myself that if I ever went to the, I want my first Derby, my first experience of the Derby to be the walkover and everything, so I can experience it full hand. So.
Well, if you thought you were nervous saddling Weekend Fun the other night, just think of how nervous you're going to be walking over with 150,000 people screaming and going crazy, getting ready for the Derby.
Yeah, that'll be it. I'll take it.
Yeah, you welcome it, right? You want that feeling. You want to be nervous on that day.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself eventually, Jamie, going out and you know, going to, say, a Fasig Tipton sale and picking out some horses there? I know you said that you did it with the horses of racing age, but is that something that you look at making a big part of your program going forward?
Yeah, like the two-year-old sales are good, but I feel like there's more ability to find good horses at a reasonable price at the yearling sales. And I had yearling consignments. I've been around the sales a lot and doing the breeding and everything. And so I feel like the yearling sales would definitely be some way I'd like to fill up my barn with good yearlings. So, but I feel like a lot of these more expensive horses, it gets to the point where I'm not sure that the horse quality gets that much better in the high levels, like the really expensive horses. So I think if you can get some yearlings for 50,000 around that price range, I feel like you can do really good at those yearling sales.
Yeah, and you can do well with a horse like that. I mean, we talk about it all the time. The majority of the big time horses, the greatest stakes winners that we see out there, were not the, you know, $1.2-2.3 million yearling purchases. They're just not. The majority of those horses are the lower priced, at the lower end of the market or the middle of the market. And I've said for years that's where you need to live, because you can make a very good living with those horses.
Yeah, for sure. Like Sir Winston Arnade for 50, you get a horse like Swiss Skydiver that was bought for 30,000. Just those type of horses, you can, like you said, you can do really well.
You got to spend some time around Got Stormy too, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had her with me at Saratoga, and that's a very cool filly. We had her at Saratoga this year, she'd kind of gone off form a little, and a lot of people were starting to write her off. But we know that she loves Saratoga in the summer. She seems to really blossom there, and she saw it again this year. Like Saratoga is when she seemed to turn her form around again, and she She ran some good races. We got her back to some sprint races, and she did really well. But I think it was kind of that running back in the four-star Dave this year. She was second to the horse of Todd's. And I think that was her big comeback performance when we knew at that point that she was back. And then she obviously proceeded to run huge at Kentucky Downs and then again at Keeneland. So
what was it like? Filly. What was it like for you? What was your reaction when you saw that she sold for $2.75 million?
It was kind of bittersweet. The good thing obviously was that Spendthrift bought her and they sent her back to Mark, so that was nice. At least she gets to stay in the system and she'll stay over here, so I can see her when she retires to be a broodmare.
Yeah, visiting with Jamie Begg here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, down to about the final 16th of a mile here on the show. Jamie, we're coming down to the wire, just about 4 minutes or so left. One thing that, as somebody who's a younger trainer in this sport, 33 years old, you're on social media. I noticed that you're on Twitter. Is that something that you will use to help stay in touch with clients maybe, or to even generate new business going forward?
Yeah, I don't tend to actually use Twitter that much. I saw you followed me this morning, so that was nice. I appreciate that.
Yeah, but my pleasure.
I actually don't have a ton of followers on Twitter because I actually kind of use Twitter as my news site. So I follow people that I know will tweet breaking news about stuff in different areas, and so that I'm not a huge I don't tweet that much. I probably will start to do a little more to drum up a little bit of business and just keep people informed of all the going ons. And I think that's kind of where the whole horse racing sport's going a little bit as well. I think the comment you said about Whittingham, like, I think the sport's going in a very much a different direction where the owners want to see their horses. They want to know what's going on. They want to show their friends. So when they work and they can get videos and stuff like that, they love that because they feel more involved in the sport. And I think that it's very much we're in an age of technology and everyone wants involvement and videos and tweets about their horses running and stuff like that. Just anything to get them going. So I also have an Instagram account for Beg Racing. And I feel like Instagram may be an area I'm going to try and push a little more in the social media side. I know Twitter can get a little ugly sometimes. So I think Instagram is more of a positive form of showing pictures and videos and stuff like that of what's going on day to day. I think it's a little cleaner. So I like using the Instagram a little more, but I do have the Twitter.
Yeah, a lot of trainers now are embracing that technology and staying in touch with their owners and keeping them informed through social media avenues. I know Safi Joseph Jr. is big on that. Mark Henning, he's out there a lot with a bunch of things. And Graham Motion, too. It's just a great way to keep people informed and do it in a different, more modern way. Jamie, listen, just about out of time here, my friend, but want to thank you for the visit and all the best moving forward. It's been wonderful to hear your story and can't thank you enough for spending the time.
All right. Appreciate it.
All right, my friend. And Merry Christmas to you and the family and enjoy the holidays.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Jamie Begg here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. If you missed any portion, pretty simple. Head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast at your leisure, and you can also do that Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, for my special guest, Jamie Begg, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Happy holidays, everybody.